around in this great big city. Fast money and the life will never show you no pity. Oh, I work hard trying to make my bones, but times have changed and I just got to move. Can't run away, I can't run away, I can't run. I can't run away, I can't run away from the things that I've done.
Good evening and welcome to Real Wise Guys Radio. My name is Denny Griffin, and my co-host Andrew DiDonato and I will be with you for the next hour. And before I introduce our guest for this evening, I want to take just a couple of minutes to introduce Marilyn Maybloom. And Marilyn wants to tell us about her play that is going to be opening next month here in Las Vegas on April 6th and April 7th. Marilyn, would you please tell the audience about How to Murder Your Ex-Husband?
Thank you. Did you plan to do that? Well, that's the name of my play, How to Murder Your Ex-Husband.
Yes.
It plays Friday and Saturday night, April 6th and April 7th. That's at 7 p.m. both evenings at the West Charleston Library Theater. That's at 6301 West Charleston Boulevard here in town. And, well, it's about a male obituary writer who guides the audience as women of various ages reveal their tales of love, honor, faith, betrayal, marriage, revenge, and murder. Yes?
Okay.
My God, that sounds good, Marilyn. That sounds real good.
Thank you.
And I am going to be there to see it.
I'm
and
what, so
what,
pleased.
What's the deal on tickets, Marilyn?
Free and open to the public. Just show up and you'll have a wonderful time. It runs about 90 minutes with no intermissions, so be prepared to enjoy. It's directed by Douglas J. Pritchard, who's fabulous. He's worked for me for about 5 years on the Strip, and he directed my autobiographical one-woman show, Thursday Night in Baghdad, which played all over town a couple of years ago. And we're looking very forward to this new play. I worked on it about 3 years, as you know, Denny, and researched it ad nauseum with everybody, including the coroner. And it should be very interesting, especially a cautionary tale for husbands.
You're going to kill him, Marilyn. Don't worry about it.
Not literally, we hope. Well, Marilyn, thank you very, very much for calling in. And we will see you in April.
Thank you. Thank you, Denny. Thanks for having
me.
I look forward to seeing you.
You
bet. Bring your friends.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, we have with us tonight, our guest is Mr. Anthony Curtis. And Anthony is a publisher and author himself, and of Huntington Press, and also the Las Vegas Advisor. Anthony, welcome to Real Wise Guys Radio.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Hey, Anthony. How are you?
Great.
I'm good. I'm pleasure to be here. What are we going to talk about here today?
Well, we're going to talk about a lot of things. I'd like to start out, if you could. Could you tell us a little bit about your background, Anthony? I know you've been in Vegas for several years, but are you originally from Vegas?
No, I'm actually from Detroit, and I grew up in Detroit in one of the suburbs called Dearborn. My folks had come right from the middle of the city, so we had a few connections back there. I was I knew a few people back in Detroit back, you know, through my dad's days as a kid, and most of his buddies went into some odd pursuits. Well, I wouldn't say most, but a few of them. I was a wrestler in Michigan, and I was good enough to get some scholarships, so I ended up going to college away. I went to Duke for a little while and then out to UCLA. And when I turned 21, I came to Vegas, and that was in 1979. So from that point forward, I've been in Vegas. So I've been here over 30 years now. And I just, you know, I had the good fortune of coming here right at the tail end, the last decade of, you know, the old Vegas, and got to see the whole beginning of the new Vegas, which, you know, in my opinion, started with the opening of the Mirage in 1989. But that 10 years before was a pretty wild time. I mean, you know, guys like Spilotro were alive and kicking here. You know, he was basically in his heyday running the strip. And I met a few interesting characters back then.
Yes, in fact, you 79, that was about the same time a fellow named Frank Collada showed up. So it was, he got here in that same era.
Well, here was the weird
thing. They were exciting times.
Yeah, here was the weird thing about it, which I now know, I only know this now in hindsight. When I got to town, you know, I'd heard lots of stories about Vegas and the mean streets and all that, but what I really come here to do was to play blackjack for a living. And I'd studied card counting and the mathematics of blackjack very, very diligently. In fact, I spent more time studying that than I did my regular studies while I was in college. And I was pretty prepared to play, but I didn't really know what I was getting into in terms of, you know, being on the streets here. And for some reason, just out of weirdness, just out of luck, one of the places I originally used to hang out was called the Tower of Pizza here, the Leaning Tower of Pizza. And I'd go into this joint, and it was always hopping, and it was always, you know, it was just full of characters and everything else. And I'd get into a little argument here and there, and, you know, nothing really escalated. But I didn't know at the time. You know, I felt pretty confident because coming off of wrestling in college and all, I felt I could take care of myself. But I didn't know who I was dealing with back then because that was the hangout, you know. That was the place where the boys used to hang out. I had no idea. You know, I didn't know who I was mouthing off to or what I was risking or anything. But I think the only thing that might have got me through that was that my folks had taught me to be respectful of the elders. So I was always really nice to the older guys, and maybe that was my salvation.
That was just saving grace.
Thank God.
That was just saving grace.
Well, anytime a guy would come up and talk to me, and oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Danny.
Well, I've never, you know, I've played a little nickel dime poker, a little blackjack, that type of thing. I've never been a big game. I don't have the nerves. I've done certain things in my life that take some nerve, but when it came to gambling, I never was willing to put the money at risk. You know what I'm saying? I just couldn't do it. Like, I'd reach in my pocket, and my hand wouldn't come out. So when it came to big gambling, I'm talking, you know, major stuff. Now, did you learn how to play or start, like, back in Michigan then, or was it while you were in college?
Well,
or when did you take up an interest in gambling?
You know, it happened for me. I wasn't one of these kids that grew up and gambled all the time, even though gambling was all around me. But I played games. I played games like a madman. And I just was really into, I had a natural understanding of probability as a kid. So I could play a game like Yahtzee or Risk or something like that better than the others. You know, Monopoly was another one. Sorry, these kinds of games, I always seemed to win. And I played them, and the reason was, I look back at it now, and I really understood how dice worked, and I understood, you know, when I was more likely to land, you know, on a hotel in Monopoly, or, you know, what was, you know, just kind of what was more likely to happen in a game of Sorry. So I would always kind of come out ahead on that. And when I was in 11th grade in high school, a friend of the family gave me a book on blackjack card counting, and he said, I think you're going to really understand this, and I think you're going to like it. And I fell in love with it. I read it. I understood it. I couldn't wait to turn 21, and for the next 5 or 6 years, I read everything I could get my hands on. And when I came to Vegas, you know, I was prepared. I was ready to go.
Did you actually put those lessons to use, Anthony? I mean, was there places out in Vegas that you frequented a lot where, you know, you were trying to apply the trade?
Yeah, and, you know, I came out here, and I was pretty short-stacked, as they say. You know, I had about $2,600. And, you know, this is a true story. I've told this a couple of times, so maybe some of the listeners have heard it, but I'll run through it. I came here the first day. I had $2,600. I put about $400 down on a place. You know, this is back in 79. It didn't, you know, it was maybe $3-something a month to get a dumpy old apartment. And my folks had helped me move out because I'd come out from Huntington Beach, Orange County in California. And we went to the Sahara that night. And I said, I was going to treat them to a buffet. And I said, you guys go, you know, get in line, and I'm going to play blackjack a little. So I won $23. And I walked in there, and I was like, man, this is going to be so, you know, easy. And I brought my folks a buffet, and, you know, everyone was all smiles. And they went home, and the next day I went downtown, and I lost
$1,800.
The town
could be unforgiven, Anthony.
No, I put myself behind the eight ball real, real fast. And then it was work your way back from there. And so I learned real quickly what I needed to do. I had to play low stakes for a long time to build things up, and I had to learn the ins and outs of the town. And I definitely took some side jobs. I was a lifeguard for a while. I was a bouncer in the bar. I was like the smallest bouncer in Vegas, but I got that because of my wrestling background as well. And I was able to kind of keep things together long enough till I got on my feet and was able to really start playing. And from there, hooked up with some of the teams like we see in the movie 21. I played with guys like that, and we got pretty serious. We started playing some pretty big money, and we had some pretty big scores, and it kind of, it went from there.
That's interesting. See, Anthony, go ahead. Go ahead, Dennis.
I was just couldn't help but wonder, after you took that $1,800 hit there the night after you won the 23, you were, like you say, pretty short. Is it much tougher to play when you don't have the bankroll? I mean, is there a lot more stress and pressure on you with each hand?
Yeah, I guess so. You know, anytime you're, as they say, down to the felt, you know, when you're really putting it out there and you got nowhere else to go, you know, butt up, and if you got nothing, you got nothing. It's a little, you know, it's nerve-wracking. If things go bad one more time, you know, then what? Then you got nothing. But, geez, man, I mean, I'm 21 years old at that time, 22 years old, and I'm thinking to myself, come on, if I can't go out and get a job, I'll go shovel, dog crap if I got to do it, And in a way, that's kind of what I did as a lifeguard. Everybody goes, what a cool job as a lifeguard. Well, hell no. Being a lifeguard is running around and fetching towels for people, and carrying chairs and things like that. And, I was willing to do that, so I didn't really care. But I also had a very, very, again, I had a good understanding of probability and how things work. So I realized at all points throughout my career how much I really could bet. And even when I got flush, even when I had money behind me, by that I mean I got to a couple grand or even more, I didn't go crazy. You didn't see me out there with $100 bets. You saw me out there with $10 and $20 bets protecting my bankroll. So, I kind of knew how to navigate those, those treacherous waters. But, yeah, there were some lean times. I could tell you stories about, having 68 cents and buying a potato and a carton of Emo, because I couldn't afford sour cream.
Wow. See, the difference is, Anthony, what Dennis said before about he put his hand in his pocket and he couldn't get it out to make the bet is that's the difference between a guy who gambles, because a guy who gambles, the money to him is a tool. It's part of his trade. It's a tool. A guy like Dennis, it's money. It's like savings.
Right.
It's this. It's that. It's not a tool. So, and that's why gamblers are different than regular people, because gamblers, the money, let's face it, the money is just, it's like going out, if you're a carpenter, you're going to bring a hammer. Money's the same thing.
It's exactly correct. And the way I looked at it, the way you've just stated it, is precise. It's precisely accurate. The way I looked at it, though, there was a different spin on it for me. My feeling was, I can't win if I don't make the bet. I've trained myself to do this. I've trained myself to recognize positive situations, is the way we say it. I've trained myself to recognize times based on counting cards or whatever I'm playing in a tournament or whatever, that I have an advantage. But if I don't get the money on the table, I can't exercise that advantage. So it was very, very easy for me to get the money down, even if it was in the worst of times. It was very easy for me because the guy who taught me was a very famous gambler, a mathematician, actually. He wasn't really a gambler, but he wrote a lot about the math of blackjack. His name was Peter Griffin. And he used to say, if you don't bet, nothing can happen.
It's that New York lottery. Used to say, hey, you got to be in it to win it. That's it. That's it.
Exactly.
All
it's the same thing. It's the same idea. It's the same ideas.
What did you say, Dennis?
Did you say, Anthony, that an event? I was just wondering. Now, I think Anthony said a minute ago that eventually he started getting involved with some other blackjack players, and they worked as teams. Did I hear that right?
Yeah, here's the way it happens. When you come to this town, it's really the term. There's a term for it. When you come here and you sort of live off the land, like I was doing, back in late, 79 in the early 80s, running around looking for cheap food. You know, that's how the advisor began. I know we'll talk a little bit about the advisor, but, you know, I'd go out and find cheap eats because that's all I could afford. But I would look for opportunities. I would look for coupons. I would look for two-for-one lucky bucks. I would look for anything that would give me a mathematical edge. And there's a name for it. It's called scuffling. I mean, that's what they call it on the streets out here. You're scuffling, or that guy's a scuffler. Well, when you're scuffling, other people are scuffling too. There's other people that have come to this town. And, I mean, I'm telling you, 9 out of 10 or probably more like, you know, 98 out of 100 of them end up going home or somewhere else, or working behind, you know, on the inside behind the tables. Very few of them really graduate to the point where they're making it. And you recognize those good ones. You see them, you know, if you're one of them and you're making it, you know what it takes. And you look around and you go, that guy's good. I just know what he's doing. And we would, and they'd recognize me. And we'd get together and, you know, we'd go have a beer after a playing session. And sometimes you'd hit it off and sometimes you wouldn't. Most of the time you wouldn't. And you'd say, you know, see you around. And every once in a while you make a friend. And that's how I met a lot of really, really good blackjack players and gamblers. And eventually we got together and we got financed. And some of these guys were, you know, really good mathematicians, better than me. Some of them were computer programmers where I didn't program. So we all had these skills that we brought to the table, and eventually we formed a very, very good team, and I ended up playing on a few of them.
Anthony, did you stay just close? Did you just stay with blackjack, or did you go to other games as well? Did you, you know, craps and everything else like that?
We would play any game where we could have an edge. Now, you know, most games, like if you're talking, blackjack's a beatable game, you know, playing it, you know, almost just on the square. You know, I mean, if you're counting cards and you're not doing anything special and you don't have a special promotion, you know, that's a game that can be beaten through card counting, shuffle tracking, you know, ace sequencing, hole carding, you know, all kinds of different ways to win at blackjack that are legal. Now, a game like craps, a little bit different. You know, a game like craps, it's a gambler's game, but by gambler, I don't mean pro gambler. I mean a guy who likes action and wants to have a blast and looking for a big score. But it's mathematically, it's really unbeatable over time. You cannot beat craps playing on a square unless you're cheating or you've got something else going. But we would find opportunities to win at craps, and those would include things like a crap tournament. I mean a crap tournament where you're playing against a bunch of other dice shooters who don't really understand what a tournament's all about. You can really get it over on them. You can get a big edge on them, and we win a lot of money in crap tournaments. There would be crap promotions where they would, hit two comeouts in a row, and we're going to pay you this bonus. And mathematically, that was a dumb thing. You know, it was too easy to do for what they were paying. So we'd play the crap out of that, so to speak. You know, excuse the pun. But we would play it as long as they would pay it. You know, and we would just find anything where we could get an edge. And if it turned out to be tiddlywinks, then we were playing tiddlywinks, but only if we had a mathematical advantage.
Now, what I want to ask you, Andy, see, like, Anthony, you wasted all those years. I mean, let's face it. I mean, you opened up a tremendous business. And you're doing very well. But most people, you know, the stories aren't happy endings like that. You know, most people who go to Vegas, you know, they think they're going to take this town by storm. I mean, you happen to come with a small amount of money at the time. But I've seen people in my past who, you know, went out to Vegas with really, really big money and thought they would take the town by storm. And next thing you know, like you said, they needed a job. They started to work at a casino. They didn't know what to do. They lost everything they had. So, you know, at least you could say that you were one of the survivors, like you said, that you had the ability, you know, to pick and choose and walk through that minefield and survive it. A lot of people don't.
Well, that's because I looked at it differently. That's because I looked at it like a scientist. I didn't look at it like a gambler. I didn't look at it like a guy who wanted to get something for nothing. I didn't look at it like a guy who said, you know what, I'm not going to go to college and because I'm owed a living, so I'm going to get it this way. I looked at it and said, this is going to be hard, and I've got to be smart, and it's, you know, it might be glamorous, but it wasn't, and this is what I choose to do, and I'm going to do it right. You know, a lot of these guys, like you say, that end up working, you know, for the joints, they either become dealers. You know where a lot of these guys who played and didn't quite make it, sorry to any of them who might be listening, but they end up in the eye. They end up in surveillance, in the eye in the sky, because they're really good and they really get it, but they just didn't have quite the edge to make it, or they just didn't have quite the personality. That's the other thing. You know, you can go long, long periods of time without getting any love, you know. I mean, you can go long periods of time where it seems like every single thing you do, you lose. And you go, I know I'm playing well. I know I have the advantage. Why do I keep losing? It's hard to deal with.
In all gambling games, you know, everything is streaky. So sometimes those losing streaks are longer than others, you know. And sometimes, like you said, you could think, like, it's never going to end. Like, oh, I can't lose 10 in a row. Yeah, you can. It happens. You know, people realize,
yeah,
no.
You know,
and that's why bettors press, because they figure, how many times could I actually lose? So they press and keep chasing, thinking that they're going to win. But in reality, you can lose again.
Yeah, you know what explains this? What everybody's best friend, and they don't know it. But if you want to understand this, all you got to do is look at a bell curve. You know, we all learned about bell curve when we were in junior high school. You know, the bell curve is that, you know, the thing that looks like a bell, and it shows you the range of things that can happen to you. That's probability in action. And at the top of that curve is what happens the most. And that's what we're used, that's what we expect, and that's what we're used to happening. But both ways, to the right, is getting luckier and luckier and luckier, and you get way, way out to the right of that, and that's the guy who hits the jackpot. And then further than that is the guy who hits mega bucks. And further than that is the guy who hits the lottery. And further than that is Superman somewhere. You know what I mean? Because it just happens when you have so many different things. But then there's the left-hand side. And to the left is the guy who doesn't win as much as he should. And you go back down further, and it's the guy who has like a losing streak of 4 or 5 days in a row. And further, to the point where the guy, you know, way, way on the left is the guy that, you know, he's been playing for a year and he can't book a winner. And even a monkey could have done that. You know, so you just got to understand what can happen. If you have that firmly planted within your head, your only worry then is, oh, my God, am I one of them way down there on the left? But you gotta trust that you're going to be where you're supposed to be, somewhere in the middle.
Now, Anthony, being that you came in this town during that era when, you know, organized crime was, you know, all over the place, you know, did you have to really, when you worked with the team of guys, did you have to really, like, navigate where you guys went to try to ply your trade and stuff like that? Or you know, how'd you guys survive? Because I know I heard some stories over the years, you know, back in the '70s where they would take guys out in the back and, you know, for cheating or counting or whatever, they discouraged that somehow.
Yeah, we had to be careful. Back in those days, back in the first 10 years when I played, you had to be careful where you did things. You had to be careful where you were playing. And, I mean, a really good example of that is seeing the hole card. And for the listeners who don't know what that means, sometimes a dealer will be sloppy. When the dealer is supposed to put his card underneath, he's got an up card and a down card. And the down card is supposed to remain unseen. But sometimes the dealer is very sloppy, and he'll flash that card over and over again. Well, some guys a long time ago played, you know, purposely looking for that card. They got picked off by the casino, and you know, cops were called in and everything else. I think they were roughed up pretty good, and then cops were called in, and this whole thing went to court, and a judge made a ruling that stands to this day that says it's the dealer and the casino's obligation to keep that card secret, and anybody who sees that and uses that information is not breaking any laws. So when I heard that ruling, I said, because my feeling was always, I always declared to my friends, I will not break the law. I had a lot of opportunities to cheat. I had a lot of guys come to me with schemes from the inside. It's called playing with the help, where you got a dealer involved, and he looks at his card and tells you what he's got. And I never, ever did that one time. I only did things that were legal. And even if they were gray, and even if it sort of like pushed my conscience a little bit, like looking at the whole card, as long as it was deemed legal, that was my benchmark. So
that,
we did a lot of hole
cards, Anthony, because a lot of people, you know, if they see an option to make things a little better for themselves, wouldn't do that. So that's great discipline.
Well, yeah, I mean, some of it was pretty tempting, especially when a real pretty girl at the pool where you live is the one making the offer. You know, she's a dealer, and she says, you know, you're a good player, and you and I can do a lot. You go, we can go far this way in a lot of different ways. You know, and you're like, But I did stay on the straight and narrow there. But even when you're doing things that have been deemed legal, if you're getting the money from a casino, they don't like it. So we'd have to be very careful. If you're doing it in a place like Binion's Horseshoe back then, you could get yourself in a lot of trouble. And I was always, first of all, we try to avoid those places most of the time. Second is when we were playing there, I was always on the lookout. I was always ready to just jam right out the door. And I did a few times. When I saw it was called heat. When you see heat, I'd book immediately. I'd just book. And, I mean, I'd walk out real fast. I wouldn't cash my chips. I'd pick them up. I'd walk out real fast. And on a few occasions, I ran out. I didn't want to deal with it. So, consequently, I was never, ever back room. Nobody ever got a hold of me. And I have friends who weren't so lucky. But I was, you know, yes, we had to be very, very careful.
Hey, Anthony, now, when you went to school, did you go to school for anything in particular? Like, what were you going to college for? You said something about going to Duke and then going, UCLA?
I went to Duke. Originally, I went to Georgia Tech. I never even started there. I enrolled, but I left because it just wasn't working out, and I was a little homesick, to be honest. And then my second try, I went to Duke, and I spent a little over a year there. Then I transferred out to UCLA to wrestle for them, but I never actually enrolled in UCLA. I went to about two or three junior colleges there because I had to become eligible. And so I went to, maybe three junior colleges and one regular college. And really what I was studying, I wasn't sure what I was studying. I was one of those guys. You know, I knew I wanted to go to Vegas, so I'm like, eh. Ostensibly, I was studying economics. You know, most of my courses were based towards economics. And I even did a short stint out here in Vegas. My one, quote, real job, I was a stockbroker for Merrill Lynch for about, maybe a year and a half. And that's because I had a background in economics, and it had math involved, so I liked it. But I didn't want to do that for a living. So, you know, I was doing this stuff. The weird thing about it, guys, is my dad was a college professor. It was kind of hard for me to – yeah, my dad was teaching at Wayne State in Michigan, University of New York, at Albany. State University, rather, New York. At the time I was in college, he was at Fresno State in California. So I kind of had to go through through those hoops a little bit to make my parents happy. But when they decided I was going to drop out without my degree, which I never went back to get, they let me do it. It was very cool because they trusted me. I explained to them what I was going to do and why. And they weren't really pleased, but they got behind me. They said, you can always go back if you need to. And now they're now they're proud. You know, I mean, I have a publishing business, and they're proud of what I did.
Now you pretty much backed into that because you did that part of like your survival skills when you were going through your ups and downs in the town, going back and forth, 1 week good, 1 week bad, whatever. And this is how you started to get the idea about how to get the advisor set up. Was it something that you were just thinking about?
Yeah, it's a good, great question. It segues right from this because when I actually told my dad that I was going to drop out, and he was, he was arguing with me, and I told him, I says, look, first of all, I think it'll work. And I said, but if it doesn't work, I said, if I can only do it for a while, I said, I'm going to gain a lot of knowledge about the city. And I said, there's other things I can do. There's ancillary things that are related that I can do that this will help with. And he goes, like what? And I said, publishing for one. And I'll never forget this. My dad was driving. He was driving at the time. I was in the passenger seat. And he looked over and gave me a big smile, and he goes, now that makes sense. So, I mean, that was, publishing was always in my head. And I remembered that when I was living in Huntington Beach, California, which, if you think, my publishing company is called Huntington Press, and that's why, because when I came to Vegas, I hatched the plan in Huntington Beach. So I was in Huntington Beach, and I knew I was going to come to Vegas in 6 months when I turned 21, and I couldn't find any information about what was going on in Vegas. And I was like, man, I wish there was a newsletter about Vegas. I mean, I would read it. I'll bet it would be great. So I always had that in the back of my head that I would start a newsletter about Vegas. And when I got out here and I was playing and the times were lean and I had to, find really good stuff, well, that's when I discovered, the $2 steak dinner at Binion's Horseshoe and the 50-cent shrimp cocktail at the Golden Gate. And, the $11.95 double lobster tails at the El Cortez in what used to be called Roberta's there. And now it's called The Flame, the rest of the old-time restaurant there. And on and on and on. And, I mean, I would find these brunches for $5.95 that were just insane. And I was like, people would like to know this, So I started kind of just fooling around and floating the idea and just goofing around. This is before computers, desktop computing and everything.
Yeah.
And I put together some prototypes. I started showing them around, and people were like going, this is great. And so I put a price on it, and people started buying it, and I was like, wow, this could be good. Now, the problem was just when I started it, that's when the gambling really began to take off. And that's when I really hooked up with the best players, and that's when we really started making a lot of money. So I had to put that idea of the newsletter on hold, but I always kept it, kind of going. And I would send out these little, I called it the little tout sheet every month instead of a full newsletter. And then a decade or so later, I picked it up again, and that's where the advisor came from. And I used all these things that I learned over all this time, And by then, I'd learned so much about the gambling that it made the newsletter really good, because it wasn't just about cheap food and entertainment, but it was about, you know, different promotions around town and how to get it over on the casinos and so forth. And the Advisor, you know, really took off. I think it's probably the biggest newsletter now, really, historically in the history of the city, I think.
And which is great, because, you know, you get most people who pick up a flyer and, you know, they see, you know, places where they can get discounts on food and other things in the town. But yet, here you are, you have this knowledge about gambling, and you get guys who are gamblers who love to read on that, see? And they love to see what kind of edge they can get in certain places and where certain odds are. Of course, sometimes casinos have certain odds on their crap tables and stuff like that. And it gives them an idea of how to navigate according to where, how their pocket is, if they got big money, if they got short money. And so, hey, that was fate, Anthony. That's fate right there. That's what that is.
Well, you're right. It was a good combination, and it worked for people. And I've come to realize over the years that it does a couple of other things for them too. One is it entitles them to do what they want to do. You know, they want to come to Vegas, they want to gamble, they want to essentially blow their brains out one way or another. And when they read the Advisor, they all of a sudden think they're sharp. You know, they kind of like convince themselves they're sharp just because they've read it. I'm convinced that half of them don't even read it. They pick it up, they take it out of the envelope, they run it under their nose and take a big whiff and go, I'm ready. You know what I mean? It gives them a reason. It gives them entitlement to come here and be a moron, you know? But, I mean, okay, good enough. The other thing is that
the Advisor's giving them the inside track. They got the inside track now.
Yeah, so it's okay. So if they lose, they tell their wife, but I'm good. It wasn't my fault. You know what I mean? I read this thing. But the other thing I think is that the other group is they don't mind losing as long as they, A, have some fun and get something back in the bargain. And fun is part of it, but a real good deal on food is important. You know, I don't know how many people I've heard, you know, like this scenario. Guy goes on vacation, comes back, his neighbor says, how was Vegas? Did you win? And the guy goes, well, no, I didn't win, but let me tell you about this awesome steak dinner I had for $4. And that's what they talk about. You know what I mean? So they just want something back in the bargain.
And, you know, especially, you know, when you come to Vegas, you know, the first thing people think about is, you know, all the major casinos and this and that. And they don't know where bargains are, where they can get more for their money. And a lot of people who come, let's face it, you know, they're going to come, say, you know, a few thousand dollars or maybe even less. And sometimes, you know, to read a paper like that's going to give them the, you know, a benefit. At least they know now, okay, listen, I can stay at this hotel, it's going to cost me X amount of dollars. I could stay there 2 days. I could eat in these three places. Look, this one's got a 2-for-1. This one's got this. And they'll navigate their vacation around what they see in your paper. So that's pretty much
Exactly.
So that's good.
And it makes it better for them. It makes it better for them. They feel, you know what, they feel like they're not square anymore. You know, they come to Vegas before and they go, God, I really don't know. I'm going to act like I know what I'm doing, but I really don't know what I'm doing. So, you know, we try to give them enough information. And if they follow the advice, they're going to save money. I mean, we got testimonials that we could stack up to the moon with people going, holy crap, you're right. I did this. It worked. Wow, you saved me X amount of money. So, you know, those who want to take advantage of it, they can, you know, they can do it. So that's, you know, the newsletter's always been sort of the engine of what I did here or what we're doing here. And we just realized that we could also publish books, that Vegas didn't have really a major book publisher in Nevada except for the university presses. And we decided to start publishing books. And we had a couple of successes because I published some of the best books we'd ever done in the beginning because, you know, these were people I knew and these information hadn't been out there, mostly blackjack books and things. One book called Comp City was about the whole how to get comped in Vegas, and no one had ever written that before. And we got pretty well known. And then I got too big for my britches and thought I could go out and, like, do anything I wanted. And I started doing books on, you know, novels, and I started doing books about things that I didn't know anything about, and it didn't work so well, you know. So I kind of, like, pulled it, reined it all back in, and we started concentrating really on three different things, which is gambling, which is where we're supposed to be, a little bit on the sex thing. We did some stuff with – we did one called Topless Vegas. We did one called Inside the VIP Room. You know, we knew that those would be good. And what, guys? What? The mob books, right? And those
have
been really,
really
good.
Well, the mob in Vegas is big, so it's a big read in Vegas.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, first it was,
guys,
it's, you know. Oh, go ahead, Denny.
I got to break in just for a second because we got to do just a tad of housekeeping here. But before I do that, I got one final question about the blackjack, Anthony. It goes back to the movie Casino. I'm asked periodically about that movie, and I answer what I can, but sometimes I get asked about the cheating scene where De Niro catches the guys, and, you know, you had the sloppy dealer with the hole card like you were talking about, and then these guys signaled each other of the hole card. Was that a realistic scenario? Do you think that captured pretty much what that type of thing would be like?
That was a little bit was a little bit overblown, but it wasn't 100% overblown.
Okay.
I mean, really, Casino and 21, that movie and all, it was sort of like an amalgamation of things that happened. And what they showed there, it's happened that bad before, but it wasn't normal. That would be something that would be kind of quite a bit out of the ordinary. But to say that could never happen would be wrong. Stuff like that did happen, so it just didn't happen all the time. They might bounce you around. They might slap you around a little bit and throw you out the back door, but they usually didn't crack you up that bad.
Okay. Just a little housekeeping here. Anybody who has a question for Mr. Curtis, you can call in at 646-478-0982, and our producer, Kim Colton, will take the question, and near the end of the show, we will ask Mr. Curtis. And you can also ask the question through our chat room, and Kim is monitoring the chat room, so if you have a question for Mr. Curtis, you can also ask it there. And again, at the end of the show, we will ask Mr. Curtis to answer your questions for you. The other thing is I wanted to mention our theme song was recorded especially for Real Wise Guys Radio by Mr. Sonny Charles. So I want to thank Sonny for that song. And
I want to thank Sonny very much for that song. Sonny wrote that with us in mind. It's a beautiful, it's a really, really good song. I mean, it's got that street beat to it. And the whole song in itself, I mean, you only get to see hear 25 seconds of it or so at the beginning of the song. But he's coming out with a CD soon. His CD is going to be really, really good. I had the opportunity to listen to a few songs that's going to be on a CD that's going to be released soon. And it's excellent. I mean, this guy's a legend. I mean, he's, you know, done Vegas for a very long time. And now he goes on tour all over the world. He's a very talented guy, Sonny Charles.
And the title of the song, by the way, is The Life, which is very appropriate. Okay, let's get one other piece of house cleaning out of the way. And, Andrew, I think we should just mention Real Wise Guys, which is...
Oh, yeah, Real Wise Guys is coming along really well. Yeah, Real Wise Guys is doing real well. We're doing a lot of speaking engagements around the country, and I can't be happier with the outcome and, you know, with the feedback we're getting from everybody. You know, it's a collaboration of a lot of guys who are into life, who want to give back to the community a little bit. And we try to make it fun. You know, in Las Vegas, there have been some times we've done, you know, bachelor parties, weddings for people and stuff of that nature. And it's been real interesting, Dennis, really, really interesting.
And anybody who wants information on Real Wise Guys and what they offer, you can go to www.realwiseguys.com. And you'll be able to get the information you need or send in a question via email from the site. Okay, let's get back to Anthony. We were talking about the Huntington Press and Las Vegas Advisor. First of all, Anthony, if somebody wants information on either the book publishing or the advisor, where would they find it?
I'll give you that in just one second, but I was listening to you here during the pause, and I just want to say that... One of the things I used to do, one of the original bargains and values I found that really was a way for me to blow off steam, is I used to go watch Sonny Charles when he was one of the checkmates along with Sweet Louie.
Yeah,
and I
Sweet
saw
Louie.
Him at the Sands. Yep, I saw him at the old Sands, and I saw him at the various Arizona Charlies, and I used to follow those guys around. They were so good.
Hell of a nice guy.
In some of the early days. Yeah, and very talented because, you know, when the song came on, I was like, I never heard this. I wonder where this came from. But, it was at one time, it was in the Las Vegas Advisor Top 10, just go see the checkmates because they were playing somewhere and there was like a no-drink minimum. We're like, you can't get any better entertainment, you know, for nothing. But anyway, back to the question. Thanks for asking. You know, the best way to get a hold of us these days, obviously, you know, things have changed so much, but it's on the web, obviously, you know, and Las Vegas Advisor is lasvegasadvisor.com, and you can track down basically anything we're doing there. And even people that might be listening that have a manuscript, you know, you never know. Somebody hears something, they go, wow, I could write a book, or I've written a book or whatever. You know, they can get a hold of us through that, through LasVegasAdvisor.com.
Great. So that's the key. Now, if somebody was interested in enrolling or subscribing to the advisor, they could do it right over the Internet?
Yeah, they can do it over the Internet. And, you know, the website's got a lot of information that's just free. A lot of people just come. We get something like 140,000 unique visitors a month now to LasVegasAdvisor.com. And believe me, we don't have 140,000 newsletter subscribers. But, you know, those who do want to subscribe and really get into it and get the newsletter from us and get the big package of coupons that we do and the online coupons that we now do, they can do it for as little as $37 a year. So anybody who wants to do that, you know, you're welcome to it. If not, just come and hang out. And we put up news every day. Every time we hear something happen, we put it up. You know, your guys' books came out and, you know, Andrew's book, Surviving the Mob, and, you know, there was a special price there for everybody, not just for LVA subscribers. So, you know, there's reasons to come by and take a look.
Excellent. And I've been on the site many times, and I highly recommend it. There is a wealth of information there.
Especially
and a
if
lot
you're a gambler
stuff,
as well, because if you're a gambler, Anthony's got all of these books published from some of the best gamblers in the country. I mean, you know, there's people out there. I mean, there was a book recently, Anthony, what was it about? That woman, Duke, is that her last name?
Yeah, Annie Duke, yeah. It's called Decide to Play Great Poker. She's one of the top poker players in the world, certainly the top female player, but Annie's real smart. I think Annie's she's a guy poker player in disguise. Oh, no, she'd be so mad if she heard that. But I'm just kidding. Annie's just she's just tough. You know, you forget she's a girl because she's so good and, you know, and tough when it comes to that kind of thing. So we do. You know, Andrew, we should say in your book, you know, you're in Denny's book, Surviving the Mob, we did that one chapter together about gambling and, you know, in the rackets and how it works.
Yeah.
And I still do this. You know, we all three of us collaborated on that. We worked together. You know, I got involved a little bit and you introduced me to some of your guys, and we talked on the phone, and I've still never really seen as much information in one place about how the mob gambling goes, and that's thanks to you and the connections and, you know, who you put me in touch with there.
No, I get a lot of feedback from it every day, Anthony, and people tell me, you know, especially when I run into people who are gamblers, and I run into them all the time, and they're like, you know, I was reading in your book about, you know, about the odds were on crafts in certain places, and they were talking to me about the numbers game in New York, and you'd be surprised, like, just the interest, because, you know, I mean, don't get me wrong, everybody loves, you know, guys love to gamble, but they love to talk about it as well, because it's a good subject matter, like guys who play poker, they sit around and they talk about where the good games are, and everything like that. And then it gives them a little history lesson on how things used to be in certain locations and what was the difference between New York craps and, you know, Western craps and stuff like that. And it puts a different perspective on it because a lot of people who are just laymen just think that, you know, all right, craps is so, but they don't – once you start to know the, you know, the numbers game and how everything is done in certain places is different – you know, a guy who's into it is going to want to get the edge one way or another. So he'll go to a place where he can get that extra edge, you know. And it was very, very interesting. And I thank you for your input in that. It worked out great.
Well, that was, for me, the best part of it. It was a learning experience. You know, the book's full of stories and things. And, I mean, obviously, here I am promoting my book, your book. But, I mean, there's a lot of good stories. But for me, who loves gambling and wants to know as much about it as I can, holy mackerel, man, I went to school with the information that I got just from, you know, working on that chapter with you guys. So, anyway, yeah, that's a cool part of it.
Anthony, I'd like to talk a little bit, if we could. I know you've been here since 79, and, of course, Vegas, obviously, there's been a lot of changes that you've seen over the years. And the people I talk to frequently will tell me Vegas was better when the mob ran it. The casinos were more player-friendly or customer-friendly. They didn't care necessarily if they made a profit from every division. In other words, food and beverage or something might be kind of a wash. It was gambling. The casino was their main impetus. And they claim now it's a totally different thing. They, you know, the money's money from each department's the bottom line and so forth. Do you have any thoughts or feelings on the changes to Vegas? Is that pretty much true? Was it more friendly casino-wise, maybe in the 70s?
Well, I think that all the points that you made are valid, and I think that you know, they could all be defended that it was better then for that reason, this reason, and that. But I don't particularly feel that way. I honestly feel that Vegas continues to get better and better as we go, and the reason is because it gets bigger and bigger, and there are more opportunities. Back when I came here, it was so much smaller than it is right now. And I mean, obviously, the decade before me and two decades before me, it was smaller yet. And you're at a point where there were only so many options. Even though there were a lot, there were still only so many options. And the people who talk about how great it was back then when the, quote, the boys ran the town and all that, they were typically the more privileged people. They were the people that were known to the boys for one reason or another. They were higher, kind of a higher echelon in terms of their citizenry here. You know, they did something. They owned a business or whatever. You know, that wasn't always the case. But the people who loved it so much back then were the people that were getting glad-handed so much. And then all of a sudden, they weren't, you know, as big a fish as they were anymore as Vegas got bigger and bigger. So I think that there's a bias in that when you hear that from so many different people. And people just naturally like to dislike big corporations. But I look at all the options and all the things that you can do today and all the still really good deals that there are on both the low end and the high end. And I honestly don't miss those days. I'm glad I saw those days, but I really don't miss them. I kind of like these days.
Okay, speaking of these days, it's been in the news quite a bit. Well, it's been in off and on for a couple of years, but just recently was the opening of the Mob Museum downtown, and that's located in the old post office building on the Stewart Avenue.
Right.
And there was a lot of when it was first announced that the museum, Oscar Goodman, who was mayor at the time, was pushing for it. And it, you know, there was some of the locals supposedly didn't want it. A lot of the tourists, it seems, when they took a survey or something, the tourists wanted it. But anyway, it's now open. It came to pass. It's open. And have you had a chance to visit it yet?
I've been there, but not since it opened officially. I was like one of the guys that got invited in to be walked around while they were still working on it, and I got a real good sense of it. You know, I got a real good feel for what it is, but I still haven't gone over and actually, which I need to do. I want to compare the two of them. You know, I want the reopened one at the Trop, which didn't do so well to start.
Yes.
But my sense of it when I was down there, and you know, the one downtown, is that it was really good. I mean, I got to be honest. I was really impressed, and I typically don't go, you know, too overboard on that. Regarding, you know, locals who didn't want it, I don't buy that either. You know, that reminds me of the, you know, they say we don't want to be associated as a mob town. We don't want to be that. We don't want that part of our history being known. And yeah, and the NFL doesn't want people betting on their football games either, right? You know, what a bunch of BS. You know, if there was no betting on football, the NFL would be a fraction of the size it is. People watch football because they got a wager. But I mean, it's the same thing with the mob. The mob was part of Vegas, and it was a real interesting part that made Vegas Vegas. And I think the Mob Museum downtown does an excellent job, and I really like their price points. You know, the Trop Museum was way too overpriced. This one's got the highest you pay to go in that joint is $18. And, you know, you can almost get a discount if you're a guy who's left-handed with red hair. You know, I mean, they got so many discounts there, it's unbelievable. And, you know, I think it's a real good value for your money down there.
And you mentioned the Tropicana. Now, that opened originally as the Mob Experience, if I'm correct. Then it had some financial issues and other issues and closed down or almost closed down for a while. Went into bankruptcy, I guess. And it's reopened, maybe two or three weeks ago, I believe, under a new name called the Mob Attraction. And I don't know, I've never been to either. I wasn't there when it was the Experience. I haven't been there since the Attraction. Have you been there or heard any scuttlebutt or heard anything about how it is today?
I haven't been there either because I want to go to the two of them almost back to back. So I haven't scheduled the trip, but I've talked to a lot of people who have been there. You know, they came out of the box wrong. They, you know, again, they had a $40 price tag, not a whole lot of discounts, a lot of feuding from within. They just did it wrong. And I think the downtown museum went to school on them and said, okay, we're not going to do it like that. And they took a look at everything they did wrong and made it better. Then I think the Trop Museum went to school on downtown and they've opened up better. I've heard that they've got a lot of good elements there too. So I'm looking forward to it. Is this town big enough for two of them? You know, in the parlance, I don't think so. I think it's going to be one or the other.
I look at one looks like entertainment, the other one is history lesson, and that's how I look at it. I mean, from what I could see from the standpoint of when they first opened the Mob Experience, I heard that, you know, there was a lot of actors and, you know, a lot of role play like that. There wasn't, you know, they didn't have like, you know, the real guys, you know, going in there and stuff like that. And I thought they, you know, so I thought it was more entertainment than it was actual, like.
More entertainment.
That's probably
than history.
Well,
yeah.
than the real deal. You know, you're probably right. From everything I've heard about it, you're probably right. I just think that the downtown one has got so much going for it, and it's not just Vegas Mob. I mean, there's a lot of Chicago and a lot of New York and even Detroit and, you know, I mean, even Omaha for that matter. There's a lot of really interesting stuff there. I mean, you can get lost in that joint for several hours. And I just think it's got a lot going for it. And it's not fair because I haven't given the Trop its fair chance, but I will.
Yeah, and you know what I'm thinking, we just mentioned a minute ago, Anthony, that, you know, is the town big enough for two? And I thought about that quite a bit myself. And I'm wondering if they take it not as direct competitors in the sense they're both doing the exact same thing, but, you know, looking at the Mob and the Mob history, but a little bit different perspectives. The one that's strictly like the downtown, the Mob Museum, the strictly historical stuff, and then maybe the if the attraction at the Tropicana went a little bit more of an entertainment venue than just straight history, maybe they could both survive. I don't know.
Yeah, well, I mean, you guys have the same take on it, and that sounds like the way for it to go. But, I mean, who knows about this town? Supposedly they're building two gigantic 500-foot Ferris wheels. Like, do we really need two Ferris wheels here? You know, I'm like, I don't get it. But I guess everybody likes to compete. I don't know.
Oh, God. Okay. In just a couple of minutes, we're going to check with Kim to see if she has any questions for you because time's going by lickety-split here. Other than before we get to that, though, I was curious about what you think of the efforts, and the museum was one of those, efforts to revive downtown. And they got the new, what is it, the Smith Center, is it?
Smith Center.
Just opened.
Yeah.
And what are your thoughts about that? Do you think they're going the right way, Anthony, and do you see downtown, you know, rebounding to glory status?
I think that downtown is becoming one of the coolest parts of Vegas. And, you know, you can really kind of, you know, tick them off, all the things that are happening. I mean, by tick them off, I mean, you can count them down. The Mob Museum is one. The Smith Center is another. You know, the reopening of the Plaza is another with the Oscar, you know, Goodman Steakhouse, which is kind of cool. You know, I ate there, had a good steak. You know, it's pretty good. I mean, the Golden Gate is getting completely revamped. The Fitzgerald's is now the D. I was there yesterday. I was at Fitzgerald's yesterday. I mean, at the D. I was at the D yesterday. You know, drinking at the Long Bar, this new bar they put in, is supposedly the longest bar in all of Nevada. And that's a long damn bar, I'm telling you. I mean, there were a lot of people there. 2 weeks ago, I went to the... I went to the first day of the farmers market down there on Friday. It wasn't very good because they were just getting started, but you could see the potential of that. Afterwards, I went in and I got, you know, 10 under 10 lunch specials. I got pot roast that was awesome at Triple George. Last night, I wanted to eat at Don B's at the D, and it wasn't open, so me and the guys I was with went to Triple George again, had a great steak. I'm just like, you know, Binion's is still cool. You know, they're doing things and they're trying things. You know, I like downtown. I like the Four Queens. And then there's the Fremont East, you know, that district, the bar district, which is trendier, and it's for a younger group. And it's, you know, they just opened a new restaurant down there called Le Thai. If you like Thai food, really good Thai food, hot as hell, man. Don't tell them number five. You know, they go zero to five. Don't tell them five unless you got the goods. I mean, it's something. And they're in a drink. They're in a meal there that's more than $10. So I mean, I obviously I'm pretty bullish on downtown.
I like what they're doing downtown as well.
I was just going to say, if you're a person, if you have any disabilities perhaps, or maybe you can't walk all that far or for that long, downtown, because those properties aren't as huge as the strip properties, you can cover a lot of ground down there without wearing yourself to a frazzle like if you were trying to walk the strip.
That's one of the best parts of it, is you can see so many different joints down there, and, you know, without knocking yourself out, you know, you can see 10 places down there in an evening with ease. And, you know, don't forget the Fremont Street Experience, that laser show, the canopy is what it is, really, a light show. You know, we take it for granted, but boy, every time I go and that show comes on overhead, I watch the people, and the people are just mesmerized. You know, they haven't seen it before, and they're taking pictures, and it's on their video, and it's a great free show down there. So there's a lot of reasons to go downtown.
And I see them, like you say, you watch them, and they're looking up at that overhead canopy, and a lot of them dance to it. You know, they're swaying back and forth with the music.
Yep. Not to mention the girls who are go-go dancing to the music.
Kim, do we have any questions for Mr. Curtis?
We do. We have a few questions for Mr. Curtis, and we did have one comment in the chat room. A guest commented that he loves our intro song, "The Life." So that was kind of cool.
Good.
And this first question is from Mikey from Canada, and he says, "Hello, Andrew, and hello, Denny."
Hey, it's Mikey Fireball, Dennis.
Yes, exactly.
Mikey Fireball, special
Mikey
shout out.
Mikey Fireball, my man, has everything. You, to you and your family, God bless.
And his question is for Mr. Curtis, and it is, back in the day there, did you ever really see Tony Spilotro and Frank Collada out on the town?
That's an awesome question. I think I did, but I can't say for sure. You know what I mean? It's like, I find out now that I was in all the same places, and I was like so square. I didn't really know. Now, I wouldn't have known Frank. I know Frank now. I published Frank's book, Collada, and I've got some pretty funny stories about Frank, but actually, you know, after getting to know him. He got mad at me once, and that wasn't good. But, I mean, I probably did, but I can't. You know where I saw him? I saw him obviously on the news and everything, and I said, wow, that's downtown. You know, that's there. I know where they are. But the guy I did really know well, who we haven't even brought up in this discussion, was the guy who was famous for fixing sports, one of the first guys ever to fix sports and get caught for it. It was the Boston College point shaving scam, and it was a guy named Richie Perry. And Richie got the name Richie the Fixer. And Richie ran with a lot of guys, and the reason I know Richie so well is, and I got to be friends with him, really. And the reason I knew him is because Richie, being a sports bettor and all, he was really into gambling. So he had learned that I was good and doing well. He had learned that I hang around with some of the top, you know, gambling mathematicians. So Richie wanted, you know, he got himself in with us, and he wanted to be a part of what we did. And I knew Richie. So that was as close as I got to the really, really big names. I certainly never was introduced to Tony Spilotro, you know, shook his hand and knew who he was.
Okay, and the next question we have is from Rhonda in Illinois, and her question is, what is the difference between a traditional publisher and self-publishing?
Wow, very good. It's good. That difference is narrowing. That difference is changing every day with desktop technology, with e-books, with Amazon. A lot of the things in the old days, self-publishing was something that you simply didn't want to do because you just didn't have the means to get the book out into the general public. It has changed a lot, mostly because of Amazon. You can, if you have the wherewithal to put a book together, meaning, you know, you can write it, you can get it edited, you know, maybe you hire somebody to help you edit it, you're able to get it, there are companies that will put it between, you know, on pages and between two covers for you, you can go to Amazon and you can put out your own shingle. You know, you can set up your own shop and you can be a publisher. The stigma that goes with self-publishing has been very, very much diminished. The reality, though, is even in this day and age, except for a few and far between, you're just not going to have the same clout of what a, quote, real publisher has. You're just not going to have the connections that we have to get your books into, let's say, we just made a deal with Costco after years. It took us years to get into Costco. And so these guys' books are going to be in Costco and Sam's Club. You know, we've got bigger accounts with the traditional guys. We get them into bookstores. So that's the biggest thing. But if you can't get a real publisher interested in your book, go ahead and self-publish because you can do it these days.
Excellent.
Okay, we've lost our live stream, but Kim, we've lost the live stream, but let's go ahead and finish up a question or so more for Anthony because the entire show will be available on the archive, so people will be able to hear the question and answer.
Excellent. Okay, the next question is from Robert in St. Louis Park, Minnesota. Who sets the retail price for the book?
Of a book?
Yes.
It's funny he should ask. We're involved in a little dispute right now with Amazon for fiddling with our pricing, but most of the time the retail price is set by the publisher. Now, the publisher will definitely have a conversation, or, well, at least we do. You know, if you go to a big New York firm, you have no choice. If you're an author, unless you're one of the big guys, unless you're Stephen King and, you know, Daniel Steele, something like that, then you call the shots. Otherwise, you do what they want you to do. When we publish a book, we always talk with the author. What do you envision the price of your book being? If you know, Denny, Andrew, you guys know we've had those conversations. Then the publisher has the last say. You've got to have somebody who's in charge. So the publisher basically owns the book. The authors own the words, but the publisher owns the product, the book. So the publisher sets the price, and then we have to go out and deal with the resellers. And the resellers, we set the price of what the resellers buy it from us for, and then they can discount it any way they want. So ultimately, the bookstore where you buy it or the online venue where you buy it sets the price. Amazon now in our e-books, in our Kindle books, recently, because they don't buy an e-book from you, they just sell it and pay you, they lowered the price on some of our books without telling us about it, and we have a dispute going on with them going, what are you doing? So I'll know more about that in a week.
Excellent. Okay, and the last question... Well, we have one more from Janet from Las Vegas. What is a ISBN?
Well, we got a lot of people interested in publishing. The ISBN is a number that goes on a book. This is another book question. And the ISBN is the number that goes, if you look at the back of the book, you'll see a little box at the bottom, you know, usually in one of the corners, and there's a barcode there and there's a number underneath, and that's the ISBN number. And what that is the code that tells buyers how to find you and find your book. All right, so let's say that you write a book called, you know, The Vegas Towers, and you self-publish that book. You have to go and get an ISBN, and you can go Google it, and you can find a place, and they're not very expensive. They're like 30 or 50 bucks, something like that. But you've got to have an ISBN number on the book, or you really, really limit your chances of getting it out there. All the things I just said about being able to self-publish, you really diminish your chances without that ISBN number. So be sure to go out and research that and get one.
Okay, thank you. And that's it for the questions.
Thanks. Okay, thanks, Kim.
It was a great show, Anthony. Anthony, I didn't know you were such a good interview, buddy. You're a great interview.
Well,
we
you got to hang out more often. You work all day. You get a beer, you sit down, and you get on the radio with some of your buds, and it's pretty easy.
Yeah. Well, that's true.
Hey,
that's true.
Let me just so you know, Anthony, I don't know if any of your subscribers or any of the folks from the advisor forums would be interested, but this show will be archived in its entirety within a half hour, and if you want to put the link up, you know, in case any of your people would be interested, certainly feel free to do that. And the archive.
We're definitely going to
show will be in the archive for a long time.
Well, we're definitely going to do that. You guys are pretty smart. You're pretty smart. I mean, having me on, because now for sure I've got to write about you and the advisor and tell everybody about this and about this show and about the archives. So you guys are pretty shrewd. You know what you're doing.
We're always beating the war drums, Anthony. We're always out there.
Well, Anthony, I need more authors
who work so hard. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
It's really been fun, and I hope maybe you'll come back on with us again sometime if you enjoyed yourself, and we could talk a little more.
Absolutely, guys. Wishing the best of luck
great.
With this venture. It seems to have a lot of upside.
Without a doubt. All right, Anthony.
Okay,
listen,
and our next.
My best to you. I'll see you soon, and all that other good stuff. And thank you very much.
Okay, guys. Good night.
And our next show will be April 18th, when our guest will be Las Vegas columnist and former Crime Beat reporter for the Las Vegas Review-Journal, Jane Ann Morrison. So join us on April 18th. Don't forget, realwiseguys.com, the place to go if you want to get connected. Until next time, God bless and stay safe. Good night, everybody.
You will. Bye.
Been banging around in this great big city. Fast money and the life will never show you no pity. Oh, I work hard trying to make my bones. But times have changed and I just got to move. I can't run away, I can't run away, I can't run. I can't run away, I can't run away from the things that I do.